This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
What does it mean to be musical?
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 What does it mean?
What does it mean to be
musical?
Why is music such a potent form of human expression? How do musicians select, interpret, and perform compositions? What's distinctive about the human voice? We've asked six extraordinary scholars and artists to explore the magic that is music.
I'm honored, but really above all humbled, to share a stage with such renowned performing artists as Steve Schick, David Borgo, Alec Karras, and Susan Naruki in a couple of weeks. I come this evening, despite what Alan just told you, not as a professional concert artist, which I'm not, but as a cultural historian who knows how to play a little piano. Tonight's presentation is, let's call it a lecture with musical illustrations. So let's say it's 1890, and let's say you're there, and you grew up hearing music that sounds like this. Now, that's one of the most pleasant-sounding compositions you've ever heard in 1890 and will ever hear. It's the so-called Raindrop Prelude by Chopin, written in 1838. Now, for one thing, it's completely tonal, and what that means is that all the notes I just played are in a recognizable key, in this case, D-flat major, and being in that key means that they're based in the D-flat major scale. In Western music, being in a key means being based in the scales, major and minor, of the Western tonal system. And tonal compositions, of course, can change key as often as they like within themselves, but at almost any given moment, they're in some key. For another thing, the harmonies of this prelude are pleasant sounding or consonant. There's nothing or almost nothing that would grate on your 1890 ears. There are only two chords in the passage I played. This one. Called, respectively, the one chord and the five chord, because they're built on the first note of the scale and the fifth note of the scale. That is the scale of the key that the piece is written in, D flat major. Each time we hear the five chord followed by the one chord, we're hearing what's called a cadence. A cadence is a sequence of two chords that brings us back to the home chord, or tonic, or one chord, of the key we're in. Again, D-flat major here. It's an absolutely standard feature of Western music through the 19th century, and it's basically mandatory at the end of all compositions. Sometimes it's not a five chord that precedes the one chord, there are a few others that work, but as of 1890, you probably can't think of a single example of a musical composition that lacks a cadence, at least at the very end of the composition. I can think of one, which I'll mention later. So these are two basic features of Western tonality. The music is written in a recognizable key, based in a scale, and it has cadences, at least one at the end. So let's say it's still 1890 and you're attending a piano recital by one of the great pianists of the day, Anton Rubinstein. Rubinstein was known for playing insanely long programs. So after playing the complete keyboard works of Bach in the first half of the program and the complete piano sonatas of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven in the second, he's just finished playing for his first encore, a piano transcription of the complete Ring Cycle of Wagner. He began the concert on Saturday evening, and it's now getting on toward Tuesday morning. And it's time for one of those great lifemanship moments that concert artists adore. Watch this. I can even play something short and easy. He's chosen the Raindrop Prelude. He's played through the opening section, which I just played, in D-flat major, and he's almost finished the middle somber section in C-sharp minor, which is meant to lead beautifully back into a reprise of the opening theme and then end with a cadence on a nice, pleasant D-flat major chord. You and the rest of the audience are swooning from the staggeringly simple beauty of Rubinstein's execution and from the by now irresistible urge to fall asleep. But without breaking stride or altering the solemnity of his facial expression, instead he plays this. It's 1890. You've never heard anything like this before. You check your ear trumpets to be sure that the left one hasn't somehow retuned some of the music. It turns out that your favorite concert pianist, in a moment of sadistic inspiration, has decided to transpose the right-hand part into D major, and using a musical crystal ball, has gazed 40 years into the future to discover a particularly grating chord to end the piece on. Borrowing from a piece I'll play later on, the piano variations by Aaron Copland, who will be born in Brooklyn 10 years from now. Of course, it sounds horrible. And why? Well, with the right hand playing in a key a half step above the left hand part, you're often running into sound combinations like this. Not very pleasant sounding at all. They just sound bad. So you leave the concert hall in despair, all that lovely music preceding the second encore having been destroyed by these nasty, dissonant harmonies. And about 20 years later, you're passing through Munich. It's January 2nd, 1911, and you see a notice for a concert featuring all music by someone named Arnold Schoenberg. On a lark, you decide to attend. The first piece on the program is a string quartet, but it turns out to be unlike anything you've ever heard before. It's filled with the most bizarre harmonies. In the third movement, out of nowhere, a soprano appears to sing, or rather screech, along with the string instruments, words written by German poet Stefan George. The four movements of the quartet seem to have roughly the same structure. You start off in what sounds like fairly conventional territory, but you don't stay there for very long. Then you're off on a journey through some unexplored universe featuring some of the strangest sounds you've ever heard. And yet, at the end of each movement, you're back to a recognizable major or minor chord, a cadence or something like it. Now, the strangest part is what comes next. Drei Klavierstücke, Opus 11, your program reads. Three piano pieces. What kind of piano pieces? Sonatas? Preludes? Mazurkas? Long ones? Short ones? Well, you have no choice but to wait and hear. And this is what you do here.
Thank you.
And that's just the first of the three. Maybe you're ready to flee with your sanity still intact, or just maybe you're intrigued by this music. Here's what one audience member made of the experience. It was Vasily Kandinsky, the Russian abstract painter who happened to be there that night. That's what he made of it. Increasing abstraction, it set him off on the path that would make him famous for the rest of his life. In any case, you can't help noticing that you've never heard anything like this quite before. It boils down to three features. Virtually all sound combinations are grating and dissonant. That final chord is played only instantaneously. You hardly hear it. If I were to play it more loudly and prolong it, not pleasant. The music appears to be in no key at all, and it has no cadence at the end. So let's take these one by one, starting with dissonance. The question is, what is dissonance? Is there some universal standard of dissonance, some law of nature that makes certain sound combinations intrinsically dissonant and others intrinsically consonant? Is there a difference between dissonant and sounds bad to me? If there is, then can there be dissonance that we enjoy while still recognizing it as dissonance? And here I'm going to ask you to bear with me for a couple of minutes while I take you on a simple whirlwind tour through what the field of psychoacoustics has to tell us. And I actually have two reasons for doing this. First, we want to know if there is some natural physical basis for consonance and dissonance, and above all, if there's some absolute standard of consonance and dissonance in music that's independent of context, people's tastes, and similar factors. And second, I want to show that the science actually played a role in the historical rise of dissonance in music, especially in the case of Arnold Schoenberg. Okay, so here we go, and I promise to make it as short as possible. Sound, you know, is produced by objects that vibrate and that thereby cause the air to vibrate. The air vibrations enter our ears and are processed by our auditory system. So sound consists of a physical side, meaning the properties of vibrating objects and the airwaves they produce, and a physiological perceptual side, meaning what happens in the auditory system and the brain. In order to speak of consonance and dissonance, we need to be talking about simultaneous combinations of two or more tones. So let's start with the simplest example, combinations of two pure tones. The pitch of a tone, how high it is, what note it is determined by the frequency of the vibrations. Standard concert A, for some time now, has been fixed at 440 cycles per second, or 440 hertz. And a pure tone is a tone that consists of only one frequency. The relation between any two notes, that's an interval in our Western scale system, can be described as ratios of the frequencies. And some of these ratios are extremely simple. For example, the frequency ratio between two notes an octave apart is 2 to 1. So A, an octave above concert A, is twice 440 or 880 hertz. And when we look at the ratios between any note, say middle C, and all the other 11 notes in the chromatic scale above it, we'll see that some of the ratios shake out into simple integer ratios. So for example, you can see from C to G, a perfect fifth, the ratio is 3 to 2. From C to F, a perfect fourth, 4 to 3. C to E, it's 5 to 4. From C to A, a major sixth, 5 to 3. Now, to modern ears, going back at least as far as the Baroque era, those are all safely consonant intervals. Wouldn't sound bad to anybody. Now, if you look at the chart, you'll see that some of the ratios are far more complicated than the ones I've just mentioned. Let's look at three in particular. The major seventh at 15 to 8, this sound. The minor second at 16 to 15, this sound, also called the half tone. And then there's the augmented fourth, or the infamous tritone, at 45 to 32. This interval in some past European cultures was referred to as the devil in music. Why? Do you think it sounds dissonant? Or just unstable? It wants to go here, or in the reverse direction, and get resolved into an interval that sounds a little bit more stable and consonant. Certainly in melody, it appears to suggest tension. Think of Bernstein's West Side Story, whose score is shot through with this interval. It's in the very opening, in cool, and even in the love ballad, Maria. That's the interval. Why start a beautiful love ballad on such an insecure, unstable, possibly dissonant interval? Maybe because insecure, unstable things are about to happen in the near future in that play. I don't know, but it was Bernstein's genius to use that, something you don't find in a lot of show music. But everybody will agree, whatever you think about that tritone, which I'm going to come back to in a minute or two, the minor second or half step, especially played in a certain way, and especially played in the lower register of the piano, where everything sounds worse, sounds pretty bad. Two notes right next to each other. So how do we get dissonance on the acoustical, the physical side? We're still talking about two pure tones. Each of those tones will have its own regular wave pattern. When two different wave patterns occur at the same time, they can interact in a number of different ways. Peaks coincide with troughs, they can reinforce one another. If peaks coincide with troughs and troughs with peaks, they can cancel one another out. But let's say the two waves are simply out of phase, but with peaks and troughs still fairly close together, as you can see in the slide. That's when we get the phenomenon of what's called beating, or on the auditory side, roughness. So here's what the acousticians tell us, and here we'll step over for a second into the auditory side of a thing. Pairs of pure tones will produce beating or roughness within certain critical bandwidths. To make a long story very short, for the range in which much of the music we hear is played, that's the range of the standard piano, perhaps minus the top two octaves or so, maximal dissonance for the human ear occurs within a range of 30 hertz. What's that mean? It's equivalent to a minor second or half step. Once again, that awful sounding interval. Now bear with me for a few more minutes. I promise soon to send you running for the exits with some truly ghastly sounding music, but let me just finish on the psychoacoustics. Let's get to that tritone. Back to the interval chart. According to the physics of a thing, this should sound less consonant than, say, a perfect fifth, or even a major third. I mean, look at that weird fraction up there, 45 to 32. It's got to sound dissonant in some way. But it should not sound nearly so dissonant as a minor second, the half step. But let's say it does sound dissonant to you. Or let's say that in certain contexts it sounds dissonant. The final chord of that Schoenberg piece actually consists of two tritones played together. Of course, part of the reason that sounds so awful is that they're a half tone apart in addition to being tritones. But still, it sounds kind of weird and rather dissonant. And the question is why that would be. So pure tones don't exist in nature. They exist only in the laboratory or approximately on artificially constructed instruments. Remember the electrotheremin that you hear at the end of the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations? The tones we hear in nature and coming from the musical instruments we're familiar with, or voices, are complex tones, meaning that each one is made up of more than one tone. The tone we hear as the tone, this C on the piano, say, is called the fundamental. But this tone carries with it a series of tones higher than it that we normally do not hear separately. In ordinary, non-scientific language, they're called overtones. The overtones exist, as you can see, in an ascending series, and the notes are all always the same. And here they are. With any given tone you hear played on a particular instrument, some of them may be more prominent than others. That's what gives us the quality of timbre in a sound. But no tone will ever have a series whose notes are at all different from what you see here. How do we prove that there are such things? That relies on the principle of sympathetic vibration. If an object is vibrating at a certain frequency, a nearby object tuned to that same frequency will begin to vibrate together sympathetically with the first object. So let's say I want to prove that this low C on the piano, this one down here, has the next two overtones, that's the C above it and the G above that, as part of its overtone series. What I do is I hold down the next C up without playing it. That releases the damper so that the string can vibrate. And then I play the lower C as hard as I can and release it to release its damper. If you're still hearing that upper C, it's on the overtone series. It means that the lower C had that and made it sympathetically vibrate. Similarly with the G above it. And on a great big piano like this, you can kind of hear it resonate. In fact, it resonates for some reason that I don't know more than the C, which is closer to it. And similarly, for frequencies farther out on the series, but it would be very, very difficult to hear that on an instrument like this, even in a hall with the acoustics like the ones in Prebys Hall. All right, so we don't hear these overtones separately when we hear a C played on the piano, but they're certainly there. Now, look at this overtone series with the note simply named. Say we're playing a C and an F sharp together. Even if we look no farther than the first six overtones, as on the chart, we can see what kind of trouble we're getting into. The C has a bunch of C's and G's, plus an E and a B flat. The F sharp has a bunch of C sharps and F sharps, which are a half step away from the C's and G's. For pure tones, remember, the half step is the most dissonant interval of all. So of the first six overtones, four are a half tone apart, and the other two are the same, since A sharp and B flat are essentially the same note. Okay, so the tritone should sound dissonant, right? And maybe it does to you, and maybe it doesn't. Now, we'll come back to that a little bit later. How does this all work once it goes in our ears? On the auditory side, sound waves travel through the opening of our ear, down the outer ear canal, strike the eardrum or tympanic membrane, three tiny little bones which transfer the vibrations of the air into this organ, which is called the cochlea. It creates pressure waves in fluid inside the cochlea, which, if we unwind, will look like that. The outer channels, another view, which are connected with each other, are filled with fluid, and sound waves flow through those channels in a circular motion. But here's the magic thing right here. It's called the basilar membrane. This is a most extraordinary part of our anatomy, essential to musical perception, one that might cause the most hardened skeptic to stop believing in Darwinian natural selection and immediately commence believing in intelligent design. Because you see, the basilar membrane vibrates each region to a different frequency. It's narrow and stiff at the base, wide and flexible at the other end, the apex, where it responds to high frequencies. Rather, high frequencies at the base and low frequencies at the apex. And now if you look at these tiny little hairs in this slide, Owing to a complicated electrochemical process, when the basilar membrane vibrates, they bend back and forth and release neurotransmitters. The neurotransmitters release action potentials along the auditory nerve, and that carries the impulses to the auditory cortex of the brain, where they are interpreted as the musical sounds that we hear. All right, let's move on. There were the other two topics, the not being in any key and the therefore having no cadence at the end. Turns out that other composers had already laid the groundwork for this feature sometime before Schoenberg had written his piano pieces. For example, I referred to this earlier, as early as 1885, Franz Liszt had written a very weird piano piece called Un Stern Sinistre Disastro, which floats around different keys as the title floats around three different languages and ends without a cadence, as early as 1885. I myself don't know of an earlier example of a piece like that, although there may well be one. And then there's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, the orchestral work by Claude Debussy, which premiered in 1894. Because Debussy's aim in this extraordinary composition was to render the amorphous experience of a faun, that's dude upstairs, goat downstairs, awakening from an afternoon nap and trying to remember whether or not he had just been enjoying the sexual favors of one or more nymphs, or whether he had dreamt it, indeterminacy appears to be the name of the game here. And the piece actually begins in no particular key, sounding like this. It's the flute that starts it. This is a piano transcription. I can't make the piano sound very much like a flute, but picture a flute or imagine a flute. Now, even if you don't have musical training, even if you don't have a really acute musical ear, you'll recognize that that kind of places us nowhere. You expect to have some kind of tonal thing, some kind of key established early on in a piece, and there's nothing, you can't tell where that thing is going, and it's just the one instrument, so of course there are no harmonies. Now, the piece continues in what sounds like different keys, but it refuses to settle down in any of them, and it keeps fooling us about where it's going next. In a conventional performance, it takes close to 3 minutes before we reach a cadence and establish a key, which actually here happens to be B major, even though the piece is written in E. So I won't play all 3 minutes, but just to give you a flavor of the kind of wandering quality that we have. So we've just heard that flute melody, and it's led into a chord played by a harp, an arpeggio. like that for another minute or so, and finally, after literally close to 3 minutes, it comes to this unconventional cadence. Nice major chord. But the music leading up to that had all kinds of little joints in it, all kinds of little transitions, and they never went where you expected them to go. They always went to a new chord, established a new key, always fooling and kind of teasing the listener. Now, make no mistake, this music is not atonal. It kind of dances at the margins of tonality, not so much because of dissonance, although there is plenty of dissonance in this music, that two-tone, whole-tone combination that's held for about a measure, but because of its apparent resolve to remain unstable and because of its refusal to respect many of the conventions of tonal music, such as the frequent use of cadences to establish tonality. What Schoenberg did in the three piano pieces was to combine all three elements: extreme dissonance, at least for that era, the not in any key, and the no final cadence, or no cadence anywhere. He wasn't actually the first to carry out this combination. We can find it in Charles Ives, the American composer, a few years earlier, and that's interesting, but the problem with Ives for much of his career is that pretty much no one heard this music till way, way later, when Schoenberg and others were already established and well-known. But after 1911, the composers were off and running. Let's look at just a few prominent examples. Between 1910 and 1913, Igor Stravinsky wrote three famous ballet suites. Firebird in 1910 contains plenty of dissonance, lots of lovely, conventionally consonant sections, and ends with a glorious Wagnerian cadence into a major chord, sounding like this. If you remember, it's the full forces of the orchestra playing. You can only try to replicate it on a piano, but the orchestra is playing this unison, and in the middle ranges, we hear this series of chords. In 1911, Petrushka, plenty of dissonance, lots of basic, conventionally consonant sections, and after an extended passage played in two keys at once, it ends on an open octave unison combination. And that's not dissonant, of course, but it's not conventional cadence either. So the very ending of Petrushka sounds, with the horns playing, like this. That's it. Not a major chord, just kind of evaporates like that. Rite of Spring. This is the one with that famous premiere I'm sure you've heard about, where fistfights reportedly broke out among members of the audience at the newly opened Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris. The debates continued for the last 100 years over whether it was the music that prompted the fistfights or some other circumstance. I lack the credentials to weigh in on this issue. I think it's safe to claim that fistfights would probably not have broken out at an all Mozart concert on that date and that place. To say that most of this music is dissonant is to understate the case quite dramatically. Is it atonal? Well, sure, lots of it is, but something strange is going on here. Listen, for example, to the opening. This music is played in the upper register, very upper register of the bassoon, and very much like Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, on which this is apparently modeled, it's kind of indeterminate. that melody is actually almost entirely in the key of C major, switches into F sharp major at the end. But the rest of the orchestra, the left-hand part in this transcription, is wandering around in either no key at all or some totally unrelated key. The second piece in the suite, Dances of the Young Girls, starts out with the lower register instruments playing an F flat major chord, and the upper register instruments playing an E flat dominant seventh chord. Each one sounds just fine by itself, but when you put them together, they create a horrendous dissonance for the good and simple reason that the two chords are one half step apart, meaning that we're hearing an accumulation of the most dissonant interval in the tonal system. And it's played really loudly. It sounds like this. You think that's dissonant? Wait till what happens later. This is dissonance, but it's strictly speaking not atonality. It's polytonality. That's more than one key at a time. And of course, polytonality essentially adds up to not in a key, since it's not in a single key, but it still involves retaining the tonal system. And that's a little different from abandoning it altogether, which is what happens at the very end of the entire suite. We have a scale played by two flutes, mostly a half step apart, followed by a thudding mess of dissonance in the lower registers, where dissonances always sound even more dissonant, for the final chord. So that final scale, playing it a little slowly so you can enjoy the dissonance, followed by this, followed by this lovely sound. Tritones in there, lots of contiguous half-step intervals, and that's the way the piece ends. So, not surprising that people got into fistfights. Then there's Leo Ornstein. Anyone ever hear of him? In the 19-teens, everybody knew about this guy. And by the way, your eyes do not deceive you. Those dates are correct. He lived to the age of 108. He was a prodigiously and precociously accomplished concert pianist at a very young age, precociously, but above all, he was the bad boy of music for a brief period, after which he went into eclipse. And considering he still had over 80 years to live, this must have been a bit of a bummer. One of his most notorious compositions, called in French for some reason, Danse Sauvage, or in his English, Wild Men's Dance, features a new device to delight the ears of Ornstein's audiences, the tone cluster. It's essentially what you get if you play the piano with your fists, or if you turn loose a spirited dog with large paws on the keyboard. I'll just subject you to the opening couple of measures of this one. Sounds like this. You like that? And then there's the intriguingly titled Suicide in an Airplane. Now, check this one out. Very different in sound. And will you pick up on what's going on? Of course you will. Thank you. Get it? The end of World War I, that's what airplanes sounded like. The right hand, however, this is kind of the weird thing. The right hand chords played by themselves without the sound of the propeller underneath them could easily fit into a beautiful sounding jazz or popular song composition. But that's not what Ornstein was really after. One of the crowning achievements in this mode is Aaron Copland's Piano Variations, 1930. Copland, as I'm sure you know, wrote lots and lots of completely tonal music, especially his settings of traditional American songs. He also wrote lots of modern music that featured dissonance and that challenged tonality. The Piano Variations are a supreme example of this style. Copland was intimately familiar with much of Schoenberg's music, though he decidedly did not like all of it. By 1930, it would probably be silly to speak of a direct influence of Schoenberg on the younger American composer. Schoenberg and others had already established dissonant, atonal, and polytonal music sufficiently that any young composer would have been exposed to it. Yet there appears to be lots of Schoenberg in the Piano Variations, at least the Schoenberg of the three piano pieces. The variations are constructed on a theme that appears to be borrowed from Bach, the fourth fugue in the first book of the Well-Tempered Clavier in C sharp minor, but with the notes rearranged. Bach began his fugue in this way. It's just a four-note subject. C-sharp, B-sharp, E, D-sharp. What Copland is going to do is rearrange those notes, give us the E, the C instead of the B-sharp, same note, then the D-sharp, and then the C-sharp. So the opening melody will be this sequence of notes, if you want to call it a melody. So that's Copland's version of Bach. Like Schoenberg, Copland exploits the power of sympathetic vibration early in his composition. You'll hear it in a second. And like Schoenberg, he shows a marked preference for half-step combinations, either right next to each other or separated by an octave or more. Now, in what sense are these variations? I'll leave that to you to figure out. But here's how Copland establishes the texture and structure of his piece in the first few minutes. First variation. Thank you. continues for some time. Atonal? Not exactly. Copland gives us the feelings of different keys or tonalities. Much of the entire composition, for example, has a kind of minor key feel to it, as if he'd written a piece in a minor key and then added a lot of wrong notes. Now, I may be mistaken, but I like to think that there's a heavy element of satire here, and maybe in other dissonant atonal and polytonal compositions as well. The variations end with a percussive passage followed by a coda. Now, a coda is not a common feature of variations, which usually consist of, well, variations on a primary musical theme. But this coda is constructed on the grandiose model of great symphony codas. The tempo slows way down. The pitch range extends to almost the entire length of the piano keyboard. It's loud and absurdly bombastic. But as you'll hear, it ends, after a mass of dissonance, on a crunching, low-register, hideous dissonance, reminding me of the jokes that musicians love to play when they set out to desecrate their favorite composers by playing their music wrong, as I did with Chopin at the beginning, or by randomly placing tone clusters in the middle of them. At least that's the kind of fun I like to have. So I'm going to finish my presentation with the lead-up to the coda, plus the coda, and then I'll leave you with these questions. Dissonance and atonality became staples of 20th century music, and certainly by now, most of us are familiar with these qualities. Have we become accustomed to these features the way audiences became accustomed to dissonances in Beethoven's compositions a generation or two after those compositions were premiered? Is there an absolute standard of dissonance, or is dissonance a function of context, personal taste, and conditioned expectations? And if we like or enjoy music that would qualify as dissonant by the standards I introduced earlier, is it because it does not truly sound dissonant to us, or is it because we perversely enjoy it the same way some of us perversely enjoy macabre and violent images on the screen? In any case, I leave you with those questions, and here's the end of the Copland Piano Variations.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.